Hello and welcome everyone. I am Arthur Noble from Knight Capital and the co-author of the book Leaders of Growth. Today you are listening to the Leaders of Growth podcast. This is the first and only podcast dedicated to scaling a company across Series A to Z. We discuss with founders, operators and experts on how to manage this stage of growth successfully. In today's episode, we discuss how to scale a tech team with our guest João Graça, the co-founder and CTO of Unbubble.
Once again, really much appreciate that you want to contribute. I think you have like great experience. You built a super large company. Really excited to hear more. And yeah, maybe we can start off with if you can shortly introduce yourself, tell something about the company, and yeah, how you relate to the topic.
Yeah, so my name is João Graça. I'm the co-founder and CTO of Unbubble. So my background, I did my computer science degree. And then I basically did a research on machine learning, on natural language processing, working on different topics, but including machine translation. And for a while, I basically stayed at academia. And then eventually I started working for a startup also related with natural language processing and document recommendation. That one didn't work. I was basically leading the research group of one, which was me. Then I joined another startup doing product recommendation, also in the areas of machine learning. And then that didn't work. But actually, the people that work with me, we really enjoyed working together. And so we decided to start Unbubble. So it was four of us. Drew Vasco, the CEO, also has a background on machine learning and natural language processing. Then there was a more front-end developer and a designer. And basically, Unbubble was like, the idea was to try to solve the problem that people speak different languages. So how could you use technology such as machine translation that was definitely not good enough for people to communicate freely, but we believe that it could be a great help to make people translate more efficiently. And that's pretty much how we started. I remember the first conversation we had with a Portuguese startup, similar to Airbnb, but for students. And we're asking, and they had a bunch of problems of like interactions with students that didn't speak English. And I said, listen, what if we had just one system that tells you thumbs up, thumbs down, is a machine translation good or not? Would that be useful? And like, that would be super useful because now we could rely on machine translation. And from there, we started developing the idea and actually do the corrections. So that was pretty much how it started. It started 7 years ago. We're now just after Series C last year, around 300 people, offices in different countries. So it's been quite a ride.
Yeah, definitely. Very impressed with what you have achieved in just only 7 years. And I think you solved such a big pain point that everyone can relate to. Can you maybe share a bit like, so the company grew like up to 300 people. Basically, what were some challenges you faced along the way when scaling the company?
Yeah, so obviously there was a lot of them. I'm trying to remember all of them. So I guess like in the beginning, one of the challenges, like while you're trying to find product market fit, is how do you try to focus on something? Because you'll find something that starts to work, but then you're afraid of putting all your bets there. But at the same time, if you try to touch too many things at the same time, then you won't be able to progress or to learn from your customers. And that for us was a big challenge because we started with this view of building the translation layer, which is still our vision. So basically, you can communicate with anyone in any language by any device, like written, text, and basically there'll be a layer that removes the language from the conversation. So we could now be talking in Portuguese and German, and you wouldn't understand the difference. Now, reality is very different. So even if you're just translating text, it's completely different to translate a website than it is to translate an email, than it is to translate a marketing blog post. And so we started with this mission to do all this at the same time, but it's impossible to develop technology to automate part of this. So basically that ability to be focused on one point, even if you don't have all the certainties that you should, I think it's like super important. Other topics is like, how do you scale the teams? In the beginning, you're just a group of pirates. So everybody is doing everything. There's very little control. You're just trying to push it as fast as you can. And then you start adding more people and that kind of mentality does not work. Because now you have to do organizational effort. And for instance, for me as a CTO, one of the things I learned that I would have done differently was I spent too much time coding with the fallacy that I was the faster one to code because I was a fast coder, I knew all the code. And so it was much faster for me to do stuff. And I should have spent more time actually teaching other people about the architecture, the vision, where do you want to go? Because then eventually I became a bottleneck. And also the entire team becomes slower because there wasn't this shared understanding where we're going. So people start building stuff to the best of their knowledge, but then they didn't fit together on this overall piece, especially because we had a very complex stack going from the machine translation part to the translation management, to the editor interfaces, to the integrations with the CRMs. So that was definitely something that I think people should pay attention and be careful with this organic growth. If you don't start putting the processes, performance review structure from the beginning, and you just let it grow and start adding people, it'll generate frustration. And frustration will lead to these sort of silos. And these silos will lead to this like toxic behavior. And hopefully we didn't have a lot of unbabble. And once we have it, we're able to fix it around. But it's something that definitely like you're trying to accelerate. Everybody's working very hard, but you're not going as fast as you can. And finally, one thing that it's a lot of times the oversight is you need to have documentation. There's a point in time that you need to start documenting stuff. Not only like on architectural decisions that were made, but even on the business processes, why things are the way they are. So one thing that I saw a recurrent theme is there's an interesting name. It's called the Chesterton fence, which is basically you made some decision 6 years ago. And back then you just say, okay, so I need to put a parameter here. What am I going to say here? Let's try X. Okay, let's try X. 4 years on the line, you want to change the X and you just want to change it because there was no actual reason for it. But now the people that are there, like the product team around the thing, treat it as the Bible. Like, no, you can't change this X. Like, what? But what I put it there. There was no special reason. Let's do this when it's more agile. And then you become like people don't understand why it was put there. So they're afraid of changing it. And this spans this immense process of the discovery around the product. So you definitely do lose some agility just because you haven't written, okay, this is why this is here. And this is what we're testing out. This was the other alternative considered didn't test. So otherwise you're always rediscovering the wheel. So that was something that I also think that could have made us faster.
And did you also, like the last point, very interesting. Did you also see that, let's say companies starts, as you say, with pirates, maybe up to a level of 20, 30 people. From there, they maybe make the step to like up to 100 people. And from there, like up to a couple of hundreds and where you are. Would you also say that there was a specific period in time that you said, okay, this was where the documentation became very relevant? Was that already like very early on, or like in which stage became this most relevant?
I think one particular point was when you start bringing more senior people to help you scale. So in the beginning, you have the founding team, you're mostly coders, everybody's coding. And then as you start scaling, it's not natural or even like a good choice that all the coders become managers, because some of them are extra coders and they want to keep coders. And we're talking about you grow from 5 people to 100 people in the space sometimes of 2 years or 3 years. So people haven't grown that much. It's just the company is growing insanely fast. And then you start getting these like managers, which are very good technically, but they don't have the entire knowledge of the system. And so the naivety was thinking that with a whiteboard session that you do some drawings and explain and people not, and they might understand it at the point, but as you pass like 3 months, 6 months, they don't have that understanding and there's no place for you to go back. And especially if you're in the moment like I was that I was traveling a lot to conference and so on, then you don't even have the chance to sit with the person. So people are making their best calls given the information they have. And that's why it starts breaking. So I think that there's a balancing act between, so in the beginning, you don't want to waste a lot of time on writing because things are very temporary. At the same time, I do believe that you should write the experiments you're doing. It doesn't have to be a long form text. You say, we're trying this for question A. But you should definitely have something because we start scaling and then, you know, I brought the VP of engineering. He brought some other senior people and then we just start scaling engineers. And at a certain point, I don't think that anyone knew the whole picture except potentially two or three of the early developers. But that back then they were more like on a niche on a particular team. And so there was all this decision being made that we lacked this umbrella. And it's not because that didn't exist. It was not because it wasn't explained in the whiteboard more than once and agreed upon, was because it was not written and formalized. So it was very easy for people to put stuff out of place because they weren't seeing the full scope.
Yeah, I think very good advice, especially the one it was explained multiple times, but not formally documented. And there's a whole lot of difference between that. Hey, and can you also maybe share a bit like with Unbabble? Of course, you have been a lot of experience in the tech part of the business. So let's say from the tech engineering products field of the business, what are some sort of hurdles and specific trade-offs that you came across when scaling the company?
There's also this question about doing fast versus doing scalable. And I think that is a complex problem that is very hard for people to grasp it, because if you're brought into the company as an engineering and you're a solid engineering, your kind of reputation stems from building scalable stuff. A lot of times what you want is you want to do some fast iterations and understand, does this work or not? And those two don't combine because you're always living in very short cycles as a startup. even after you have product market fit. The other thing is, you don't have product market fit period you got there, at least not at Ambev. Like, you find something, but then you have to improve the other thing. So you're always in this, you're never the Navy or the Pirates, at least at my stage. You always have to mix both of them. So that has been challenging. And for instance, one thing that we're adopting now is this dual agile track of having a formal discovery track, formal delivery track, and try to push more stuff into discovery where you can prototype or just do some code that's okay, this is not super scalable, but it doesn't matter because we just want to discover. Let's not make something scalable that will never scale. So that was one thing. The other thing is, like, early on, we switched from the more traditional functional areas like engineering. So at Ambev, we have engineering, AI, linguistics, product design, and we moved to cross-functional teams. And so this was actually also super positive, but we made some mistakes. So we built too many teams. So we built teams around the product KPIs. We built many teams that were small. So I think you should aim for like less teams with enough people, teams with a lot of junior people without the proper formalism for accountability. So you empower teams, but they have to be accountable. Otherwise it becomes just like you don't get anywhere and just generates frustration. But so that was something that it was positive. I think I believe that everybody should do it. We follow the model from the Silicon Valley product group. We're still doing it.
Also but similar to Spotify.
Yes, similar to Spotify. And I believe it is the model, but it does take some care how you do it and don't be overambitious. So those were two things. In the beginning, so I think we did a lot of smart choices back in retrospect. We started with Heroku, which was amazing because for the first 2 years, we didn't have to worry about infrastructure, DevOps, and that allowed us to grow super fast. We then went on to move to AWS with Ansible, and we now, 2 years ago, start moving to Kubernetes. I guess one challenge for that is you always have to simplify, always. And a lot of times, again, it's people like to do the best job possible for everything they do. And so the challenge is you have to tell an amazing engineer that what you're proposing is amazing, but it has a much simpler way, much faster way to get 80% of the value that we want. So map this effort to return on investment is something that is challenging because it can upset the good engineer or the good AI person because they say, but this one is obviously better. Yes, but we don't need it better. We don't need it. We just need this one and then we can do something else. And that is a hurdle that keeps coming on. I believe that you can be as big as you want. You're always going to have this hurdle because there's always more stuff to do than you have time.
Yeah, I fully agree with you. And especially in a fast scaling organization, if something is relatively simple, straightforward, it's much easier for others to take on the job rather than they have to really dive into the specific solution, which will take a lot of time and won't really scale. Yeah. Hey, and what would your advice be to founders and CTOs that basically are right now in a smaller organization? Let's say they have between 30 and up to like 100 employees. Basically, what are your insights and best practices, which you would say, hey, these are things that you guys have to prepare for?
So I think I touched some of them. One is basically focus on spreading your knowledge. There's a lot of background knowledge that you have as a founder of like where you're trying to go, that other people won't have. And it might be seem obvious to you, but it's not. Make sure that you spend more time instead of developing the product on basically telling people how you want the product to be developed. And that includes all the documentation part that we're talking about. Even just like making sure that you explain, okay, in the code, this part were a hack, and we know it's a hack. This is actually like an architectural choice, and this is why. Because people won't know the difference. And they will look at it for exactly from the same lenses. And as Paul Graham used to say when we were at YC, if you're not embarrassed of your code after 3 months, you're doing something very wrong, which is, I totally believe it is totally true. But that doesn't mean that the underlying architecture, the way you envision the thing to go, isn't there. And so you need to be very careful explaining this. The other thing that I think it's very important is to basically start documenting and establishing best practice, because you're going to be putting a lot of people and you want them to follow. Having said that, it is the case, at least with me, that I was not like a super proficient software developer. Like my experience, I was coming from academia. So you have to take in consideration that other people that you're going will know more than you, but then you need to establish the best practices. And this connects with something I think it's very important. At least for me, it could have helped me a lot, which is you're always going to feel the imposter syndrome, or a lot of times you're going to feel the imposter syndrome, which is normal, but you have to be comfortable with your knowledge because there's a lot of background knowledge that you bring from the company that you might get the best guy from Google, he doesn't have it. And so I don't say like this to you that you need to be a dick and just say, no, this is my way, do it this way, because otherwise you're going to be losing the experience from all these people. So for instance, we got a really good principal engineering that worked at AWS, Microsoft, So his view of how you run things at Scale at Unbabel, it just made us like, it was a step change at Unbabel. None of us had that knowledge. So that was amazing. Now, what I learned is also when you get these kind of people, and this starts happening mostly after Series A because you get money, you start hiring senior people, you also cannot doubt yourself. So it's more like I used to basically, if someone came and told me this is the way, I'll be like, okay, so this guy probably fucking knows it. So this is the way. And it's not necessarily the case because it might have been the way on his company that you don't know in which phase they were, but it doesn't have to be the way in your company. So right now I'm much more the other way around. It's yes, let's get great people, but this is the way. And then you can use all your knowledge and technical expertise to show me that there is a better way. And if there is, then you don't be dick, you just change it. But you don't take whatever they're saying just because of their credentials. You take it because it makes more sense and you get bought into that vision. And that is something that is hard to separate, especially because if you're getting pushed as you grow on how you have to delegate more, you have to delegate more. People always try to push you away because it's a human nature. People want to have control over a given area. So definitely don't trust yourself and don't just be convinced by what other people sold you because of their credentials, but also don't be a dick. I think it's super important. And finally, and I guess it's something that you can read about on every single book about founders, I'm going to tell the same, and people won't do it until they feel it, which is take care of yourself. The most important thing is your health and your quality of mind. And this is not some whooshy thing of, oh, life is big or life is not just about work. No, no, no. It's very pragmatically about work. So as you scale, you're going to become a manager, a leader, influencing people. The most important thing for that is your quality of mind. If you go to a meeting upset and you start yelling, not being able to establish effective communication, let's put it this way, because some people don't establish effective communication, even if they don't yell, it depends on the person, then you're just not only wasting time, but you're breaking a communication channel with the other person. So everything starts to go slow and you start having silos. So making sure that at any given time you can control your emotions, be ready to hear first and you speak, all these simple principles is so hard, but it's so important. I would say this is probably the most important thing for you as a leader, C-level, high-level manager, founder, if you're still on these roles, is to be able to enable this communication between your team and make things always be constructive. And that's super hard. So in that sense, I had coaching. I have a bunch of mentors. And I think it's very hard. If you're a first-time founder, there's no way you're going to scale on the skill of knowledge at the speed that the company grows. It's impossible. I don't think it's human doable unless you have a lot of help. It's different to say, okay, I go to Google and I'm there for 15 years and I go from an engineering, software engineering manager. Okay, it was 15 years in a company that is not changing that much. If you're in a company that goes from 5 to 200 people in 4 years, it's a different company every 3 months or 6 months. So you need help. So definitely that would be something very important. It's totally worth the investment in money that you need to do.
Yeah, that's really great. Do you use like, especially that's maybe also like on the recommendation and advice that you have for founders, is there like a specific platform that you use or was it more basically via your network that you came across the right people that could support you?
So it was mostly through my network or from the investors. So the coach came from the investors, the mentors came from my personal network or from my investors network. So for instance, ask your investor, what companies are like one or two stages ahead of me? Can you introduce me to their CTO? And then I have a lot of meetings with CTO that are ahead of me and now CTO that are below me in terms of like company scale. And it's basically, it's not that they have the answers. It's just like sharing battle scars and stories. It helps a lot. So I still do that on a regular basis and I'll keep doing because I'm still like, I feel like still in the beginning. The other thing that is interesting, there's three books or not three books, like three companies that write books that every time I talk with someone, okay, you have to read these three. For me, I would love to have read it in the beginning. So one is in terms of team dynamics and management and leadership is like read all the books from the Table Group. At least read the five dysfunctions of a team and the advantage. So the Table Group, it's amazing for that. It changes the way you think about it. If you're in engineering or in product or in AI, if you're building the product, read the Inspired book by Martin Kagan. Read the work of the Silicon Valley Product Group. How these cross-functional teams work, how these things work. I think it's super important. The other thing is like the books from the IT revolution, like the Phoenix Project, the new one, the Unicorn Project, all about how do you make the teams deliver, how to understand this concept of like bottlenecks, how to make these dynamics work. There's a lot of other very good books. So another thing is like a lot of what mentors tell you as well is, listen, this book helped me. But these three are like for these particular areas, I think they're like super insightful because you always like, again, your biggest challenge is to basically keep learning, be healthy so you can learn, because otherwise if you're upset or upset with life or not in a good mood, you won't learn anything, you won't communicate. Now, if you take that for granted, then you have to learn a lot and be humble, because you need to keep iterating.
Yeah, I think that's really well said and very, very insightful. How do you basically keep this quality of mind? Do you basically proactively decide, for instance, to work less or to exercise more? Because there is always a lot to do. So how do you do that?
Okay, so it's not easy. It's not easy and it changes. So in the beginning, when you're just coding by yourself, there's nothing like you put more hours, you get more done. Now, it's more like when you start having people to execute through you, so that basically your throughput is measured by not your work, but the other people's work. And so for me, that was a challenge in the beginning. Like, for instance, every time I had to spend a day with a lot of meetings, I got home really frustrated, feeling that I wasn't productive because I didn't do code. And that was something that if I had switched this mindset before, then I would realize, okay, now my role is to actually make those people productive. So it's the sum of their parts, not what I produce. Now, if you start doing this, you start realizing that, and you realize, okay, but if I go there and I haven't slept well, or I'm super stressed, these meetings are not going to be productive. I'm going to decrease each one of these ones' productivity, so the total sum is going to be smaller. And that's when you start thinking, okay, how can I make myself better quality of mind, better at this? And so I think that's two parts. One is the quality of mind. And so for me, it's sleeping. I had two kids on the way, so that didn't help a lot. Is exercising. And then the other part is read in terms of be the domain expert. So you can understand how people talk. And if there's a topic you don't know, you don't need to be the expert, but you need to know enough to understand what the person is talking about, to put yourself on their perspective of the world. So what I do right now, and this took me a long time to have the courage to do this because I didn't feel good with myself to do this, was I actually block the mornings. So the mornings are for me. And when I say me, is not like to play. It's okay, I go take the kids to school at 8 a.m. I normally start working around 7. Then I take the kids. Then I go work out a little bit. And then the morning is for me to work. Read stuff, think about what's happening. Because if that doesn't happen, I would just be booked in meetings nonstop. So I now have bookings at 6 p.m. nonstop. So I put those things on the calendar. I say, okay, here you cannot book anything. So this is an exception because I say, okay, this I want to do. So I'll put it here. But otherwise, it's just a request from the different sides. Just spooky. So the mornings are mine. There's a very insightful comment from, I think it's Bill Gates, when he was talking about the first meeting he had with Warren Buffett. And he thought he was a very good executive because he was very good at managing the calendar and get everyone set for meetings and everything super organized. And Buffett said, no, you're doing it all wrong. If you want to be good, you have zero meetings or you have the least amount of meetings possible because you should be reading, learning about the world to see where you're going. I'm definitely not even close to there, but that's like my North Star. Like having time to think is very important.
Yeah, I so much agree with that. And I failed so much this year. So thanks for bringing it up because it's so entirely true that to reserve time for that. Yeah, I really learned a lot from you. It was really like a lot of insights. So I trust they will be very useful for founders and operators in the wider community. So thanks a lot for basically spending your dedicated time and then on this on this talk. So that's very much appreciated.
Thanks a lot. It was a pleasure.
Thank you for listening. If you want to get access to the podcast transcripts or the Leaders of Growth book, go to leadersofgrowth.co. Don't forget to subscribe to this podcast, and I'm looking forward to seeing you next time.